Glendale is looking for a new city manager again. And the city council is interviewing candidates today.
One of the council members I talked to said she didn't know if these five were going to be the only choices, that if they're not pleased with what they have here, they could go out and look for some more candidates.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, spending on Medicaid is up around the country. One of the Valley's original sports venues opens its gates this weekend.
The role of technology in young athletes' behavior.
And helping Native American communities deal with Alzheimer's disease.
The belief is that if you talk about it, it's going to happen. You're going to get it. And so there's that stigma and that fear of that belief.
Plus, we take a spin in the time machine and watch out!
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody along with Steve Goldstein. Some clouds outside right now. Expect those to continue throughout the rest of the day. We could see some rain starting around 6 o'clock tonight. Look for a high today of 98 degrees. Cloudy chance of rain continuing into tomorrow with a high of 91. Right now, it's 94 degrees at KJZZ. More foreign travelers are passing through the Scottsdale Municipal Airport. As KJZZ's Carrie Young reports, the airport's customs office is processing 53% more aircraft than it did in 2014.
Officials credit the increased usage to expanded hours and an additional U.S. Customs and Border Protection officer in Scottsdale. Sarah Ferrara is an airport spokesperson. She says the bulk of the foreign travelers coming through the Scottsdale Airport are from Canada and Mexico.
But since expanding the service, we have seen, you know, it kind of branch out into other countries like Peru, Chile, London, Aruba, and Egypt, which is kind of just all over the place.
Ferrara says the expansion cost the airport about $162,000. Passengers pay for customs processing on a per-aircraft basis. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
AAA Arizona and Phoenix Children's Hospital conducted a focus group of 60 teens from Three Valley High Schools to learn more about the driving habits of teenagers. As KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie reports, teens are more apt to keep their focus on their phone than on the road.
From the KJZZ Newsroom, I'm Kathy Ritchie. A California man is accused of defacing a landmark in Parker, then posting a photo of the graffiti on Facebook. Lake Havasu's News Herald reports the man used spray paint to write Idiot Rock on the rock outcrop that locals call Idiot Rock. The La Paz County Sheriff's Department says it will request a warrant for the man's arrest if he returns to the area.
In just over 3 years, the city of Glendale has had four city managers or acting city managers. The current one, Dick Bowers, took over when Brenda Fisher resigned after only 18 months on the job. Today, five finalists to be the quote-unquote permanent successor to Bowers are in town for interviews. Peter Corbett of the Arizona Republic has been covering the story. Peter, what can you tell us about the finalists? Two of them apparently have some red marks on their resumes?
The ones that stood out in terms of having some red marks, as you said, on their resumes were David Garcia, who's now the Coachella, California manager, and Craig Mallon, who was at Davenport, Iowa for 14 years, which is the longest tenure of anybody in that city's history. City managers often clash with the city council, so there's a certain amount of this just comes along with the territory. But Mr. Garcia, who actually had worked in Phoenix for, I think, about 8 years in the 90s, he was accused in Chula Vista, California. They investigated him, and the city felt that he had looked at inappropriate images on his computer at work, and it had upset some fellow employees. That led to his firing. He claims it was because he was moving too fast on cutting the city budget to deal with the onset of a recession back in 2008. And then Mr. Mallon, the city clashed with the council there over a casino deal. The city was working to develop a road to a casino site. The mayor felt that he hadn't informed them about some of the deals that involving grading of the casino site, and he asked for the city manager and the city attorney to resign. The others, John Pombier is an assistant at Mesa. Kevin Phelps is an assistant executive in Pierce County, Washington, which is Tacoma. And then Susan Thorpe is in Corpus Christi, Texas, as an assistant city manager. And she had worked in a similar role in Peoria a few years ago.
Peter, have you had a chance to talk with any members of the council, even if it's just one or two, to find out what they're looking for? I mean, they're never going to find the perfect city manager, but what are some of the priorities there?
Well, they've obviously they want somebody that is going to deal with their ongoing fiscal issues. They have things have improved in the city since Brenda Fisher was brought on board, and she brought in a finance director, Tom Dunsing, who's helped them get their budget straightened out. And so I think they're going to want to continue to do that. And they also have issues to repair in the community. They took a beating over this Coyotes deal over the summer. And I'm sure they want to, you know, have somebody that will represent the city. I haven't talked a lot to the council about that, but one of the council members I talked to said this week said she didn't know if these five were going to be the only choices, that they could, if they're not pleased with what they have here, they could go out and look for some more candidates.
Wow. Okay. The reputation that Glendale has over the past several years hasn't been good. Are you surprised there's no one who's maybe an in-house candidate?
Yeah, I was a little surprised they didn't look in-house. As I mentioned, Tom Dunsing was elevated to an assistant city manager role this year, and I thought he might have been a candidate, but they didn't go that way.
In some of these cases, it almost seems like, okay, the five finalists come in, and then let's say at the end of the evening, it's pretty clear the one stands out and then an announcement is made. Are you expecting that the announcement is not going to be something that's in the next few days? This might be a longer process.
I think it'll be a longer process. These candidates are going to be meeting with business leaders and chamber leaders this evening in an open or sort of open session. And, you know, I the thing that kind of surprised me is that the two candidates that have the red marks on their resumes were the finalists, and it didn't take very long to find that they had been in hot water where they had been. So who knows if one of the other three will emerge, or if these others can explain the problems that they had in their other cities and convince the council that they are, you know, ready for this job and will do a good job.
Peter Corbett of the Arizona Republic and AZ Central. Peter, thank you.
You're welcome.
On Tuesday, we told you about a legislative committee looking into the possibility of making membership in the Arizona State Bar voluntary for attorneys. Right now, they have to join in order to practice here. Here's John Phelps, CEO and Executive Director of the State Bar of Arizona.
Lawyers are part of a profession. It's not just an occupation, but it's a profession that includes not only an obligation to a lawyer's clients, but a larger obligation that all lawyers have to the public.
Today, a different perspective. Jim Manley is a senior attorney with the Goldwater Institute and does not believe state bar membership should be mandatory. Jim, why should lawyers not be required to join the bar to practice here?
Well, the Bar Association has basically two functions. One is as the regulator of attorneys, and the other is as a trade association for attorneys. Now, attorneys should be forced to pay for the cost of their own regulations, but they should not be forced to join a group that they disagree with in order to earn a living. And so it's that second part, that function as a trade association, that lawyers shouldn't be forced to join.
Can you give me an example of something the bar might do that lawyers might disagree with?
Well, the bar takes positions on legislation all the time. In fact, the bar took a position on legislation last session to limit the bar's authority to require mandatory membership. And there were members of the bar that objected to that position, but they had no way to make their objection known. They can't drop their membership from the Bar Association. They're stuck. There are 18 states that regulate attorneys without requiring membership in the Bar Association. You still have to have a law license, and you still have to pay for the cost of your regulation. But in most states, the Supreme Court handles that regulation directly, and then the Bar Association is just a voluntary trade association that lawyers can join or not.
In the example of the bar taking a position on legislation, though, couldn't an individual attorney take the opposing view on their own behalf?
Well, take the example of last session's bill to rein in the bar's authority to mandate membership. There were members of the bar, including myself, who were in the audience opposed to the bar's position. And there were attorneys who stood up and voiced their opposition to the bar's position. But the bar then stands up and purports to speak on behalf of all attorneys. So when individuals are forced to join an organization, that organization speaks on behalf of the members, and it violates the members' First Amendment rights to be forced to associate with that speech.
You referenced the 18 states that do not require a membership in the bar to practice. How would you like Arizona's system to be set up in a perfect world?
Well, I have a unique perspective on this because I practiced law in Colorado for 6 years. Colorado is one of the 18 states that does not require membership in the Bar Association. And so I've worked under that system for 6 years, and I've been experiencing Arizona's system now for the past year. And I can tell you, Colorado's disciplinary system works very similar to Arizona's, but the difference is I was a member of the Colorado Bar Association for many years. I didn't like some of the legislative positions that they were taking, and so I dropped my membership so that I wouldn't be associated with those positions, and so I wouldn't have to support them financially. That's the same choice that Arizona attorneys deserve, and it's the same choice that the First Amendment protects.
There have been efforts to make Arizona's membership in the bar voluntary, as it is in Colorado and 17 other states. Do you have reason to believe that future efforts might be more successful than the past ones, which have not happened?
The current efforts are closely focused on preventing attorneys from being forced to fund speech that they disagree with. And so this current effort is different from the efforts in the past in that way. And it also, the current reforms, would expose the Bar Association to greater public oversight through application of open records laws and open meetings laws. And so I think greater transparency for the Bar Association is something that everyone should agree with, well, whatever your position on mandatory membership is.
Jim Manley is a senior attorney with the Goldwater Institute. Jim, thank you.
My pleasure.
Enrollment in and spending on Medicaid programs both increased during the recently ended fiscal year. That's according to new research from the Kaiser Family Foundation. The group released a set of new reports this morning looking at spending trends as well as policy changes made both in states that did expand their Medicaid programs, like Arizona, and those that did not. Robin Rudowitz is an associate director for the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured, which is part of the Kaiser Family Foundation.
In the first report, we found, not surprisingly, that Medicaid enrollment and spending is increasing substantially in 2015, and that's mostly related to the coverage expansions and the ACA. And in the policy report, I think one of the key findings that we found there was that states across the board, including states that expanded Medicaid and those that did not expand Medicaid, are really engaged in a whole array of different delivery and payment system reforms. So states are quite active in trying to reform their programs through those mechanisms.
Among the states that expanded Medicaid, of which Arizona is one, what kinds of policy changes did you find that were most common?
Well, like I said, across the country, we are continuing to see a lot of states that have been really engaged in these payment and delivery system reforms. Arizona is a state that has had managed care for a long time, and many other states are continuing to expand their managed care programs in terms of populations covered, as well as geographic areas and particularly focused on new quality initiatives in their managed care programs. So things like pay for performance and really trying to get better value for the dollars that are being spent on Medicaid through managed care. States are also using managed care to focus on better coordinating care and improve health outcomes. And many states are focusing on high-need populations, and Arizona in particular is very focused on coordinating services between physical and behavioral health.
Did you find that states were trying to deliver the same level of care, and in many ways the same quantity of care, but doing all that for less money?
Well, enrollment tends to be the biggest driver in terms of Medicaid spending. So we really see spending trends that mirror or track what's happening with enrollment. So when in the last two economic downturns, we saw peaks in enrollment, and that is a big driver of spending. And we're now seeing peaks in enrollment, which of course is driving increases in total spending across all the states. In expansion states, what we found is that because of the enhanced match rate associated with the newly eligible population in expansion states, we're seeing state spending growing much slower than total spending in the expansion states.
Do you find that states have been comparing notes with each other about what's working and what's not?
I think that's absolutely what happens across states, and that's one of the big values of this report, is that states can look at this report and see how they're doing and what initiatives they're pursuing relative to other states. And I think that's also true with the expansion. And I think states that have not expanded yet are certainly looking to the experience of what states are seeing in those that have expanded, what's happening with their enrollment, what's happening with their spending, and what's happening with these other areas of potential budget savings. And they will certainly be using that information as many states continue to debate whether to move forward with the expansion or not.
Robin Rudowitz is an associate director for the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured, which is part of the Kaiser Family Foundation. We are talking about a set of new reports the group released today on Medicaid spending and policy changes in states. Representatives of around 45 different Native American tribal communities are in Phoenix today and tomorrow for the first national Native American conference on Alzheimer's disease and dementia. It's hosted by Banner Alzheimer's Institute. Nicole LeMay is community outreach representative for the Institute's Native American Outreach Program. And Nicole, why is there a need for a conference like this?
Because the incidence of Alzheimer's disease and related dementias among Native Americans is largely unknown, and many tribes lack the vocabulary to describe dementia. And so with the result of the growth of Native American elders, it's really at a historical high, and age is by far the greatest risk factor for developing dementia. So, you know, their barriers, cultural differences, access to care, along with limited training of health and social service providers, it results in inadequate reporting, recognition, diagnosis, and treatment.
When you say that tribes often don't have the vocabulary to talk about this, what do you mean?
It basically means that they don't have that medical term. And because of those cultural differences, then sometimes they can't differentiate between what dementia is and what normal aging is. So they just think that it's just a normal part of aging, and that's just the way they are.
You are a member of the Navajo Nation, yes?
Yes.
Is this something that your community deals with on a regular basis? I mean, do the people that you know, the folks that you grew up with and live with, like, is this something that they talk about?
I think it's the conversation is there. I think there are a lot more folks, and I think it's in large, it's due by the reports that they're receiving from a lot of these celebrities that are coming in being diagnosed. My grandfather actually passed away from Lewy body dementia, and that was on my dad's side. On my mother's side, I had an aunt who passed away at 50 years old from Alzheimer's disease, and she was the youngest in the family, and then my uncle, who was the oldest, was only 67 when he died from Alzheimer's disease.
Is there a stigma associated with dementia, with Alzheimer's, among American Indian communities?
Yes, there is a stigma. In my culture, and I can only speak from my culture because the culture out there for all of the Native American community is very different. But from my culture, there's not really that open dialogue because the belief is that if you talk about it, it's going to happen. You're going to get it. And so there's that stigma and that fear of that belief. And that's a very strong belief that's in the community. So it makes it a bit more complicated and a bit more difficult to try to speak about those things in when I'm addressing presentations or so forth. So there's that fear.
Is it a challenge for people that maybe you come across that you think might be suffering from dementia to get them to get care?
Well, once they identify the reason behind some of maybe the behaviors or some of or the lack of remembering something, and then they have the information in front of them, I think they're relieved. And then they know what they're dealing with. And so they're a bit more open then to, you know, information, getting as much and learning as much as they can about the disease. So that part of it really helps.
What is the care situation like, especially on reservations?
Well, you know, a lot of the information that is out there basically deals with elderly care, not so much specifically Alzheimer's disease care. And so what happens is that because there's a lack of information on the reservation, there's a lot of folks that are trying to take care of the person with dementia, and it's kind of a trial and error. So it makes it more difficult for them to have to take care of their loved one and to basically keep them in the home longer. And in the Native American culture, you know, we often take care of our elderly people for as long as we can, and usually that's up to the point when they die. So it's, you know, within our culture to take care of our older ones.
Does that make it challenging then to convince maybe kids of people whose parents are suffering from dementia that at some point you just can't take care of your parent anymore? You have to get some help either in home or somewhere else.
It does. It becomes very challenging. And I think that now that we are in there doing this work, going into this program is actually going into the community to provide those outreach services, then to their professionals that actually work within the community, it gives them some tools and it allows them to go in and basically address, you know, what the specific needs are within the family.
Nicole LeMay is Community Outreach Representative for Banner Alzheimer Institute's Native American Outreach Program. The first National Native American Conference on Alzheimer's Disease and Dementia runs through tomorrow in Phoenix.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Ruben Lopez, and now I'm playing dodgeball tonight. Tonight we're doing open gym, so a lot of people that have played during the season come back and have fun, and we also invite other people to come out and play and try it out. A lot of people play and they're like, remember from grade school, and they're like, I can do this, and you're like, God, I can't do this. When you first start, you flinch a lot. You play more and more, you learn how people throw, and you learn to anticipate throws.
Go, Em. Jack. Go, get a ball.
Once you get your first hit, you're set. You can take it. It's no big deal.
That's Ruben Lopez playing dodgeball with the National Dodgeball Organization in Phoenix. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix, Phoenix, just want to see how easily we bruise, send us a note, the show at kjzz.org. When they're on the field or court, professional athletes make great plays, commit penalties, and sometimes completely lose their cool. A huge percentage of the games are televised, so they expect their best and worst behavior to end up on ESPN or another national network. But what about younger athletes in high school? How do the cameras or even smartphones affect how they behave? Derek Martin is a lecturer in the Sport and Society program at the University of Arizona. Derek, is there more bad behavior by young athletes, or are we simply catching more of it?
Most of the studies suggest that there's actually less, but as you point out, with everybody having a cell phone, we see 100% of it now. And when it does occur, people put it on the internet, YouTube, and it goes viral over and over again. So it just seems like there's more.
Does it seem like our expectations then are a little out of whack when it comes to especially young athletes? Because it seems like there's a coaching philosophy. You have to combine strategy with also being very aggressive. And yet, if you're too aggressive, you're going to get a penalty. Everyone's going to see it. Are we sort of expecting too much of young people to be able to sort of turn it off and on from play to play?
We have expectations of players, and there are penalties when they violate those. But there's all sorts of behaviors that they are able to turn off. They know this is a penalty, and they know to stop here. It is, I guess, a little harsh for them to be, you know, beast and violent for 60 minutes, and then as soon as the clock goes to zero, expect them to be angels.
How much tougher has it become for young athletes to have their actions filmed by fans on their phones, then to have those videos end up online and be subject to anonymous criticism.
There was a case of a young tennis player, a Canadian tennis player, several years ago, who actually quit. She was promising and sort of rising star, but she was getting abused on the internet. She lost matches, and I guess people who had bet on her were criticizing her. Yeah. They were criticizing her looks, and it was so distressing to her, she decided she'd rather retire and live a life off the screen than subject herself to that abuse.
Certainly not everyone is LeBron James. They're not going to see ESPN carrying all these high school games. But we're seeing a little bit more of it, younger and younger people being shown on major platforms. I mean, not just, let's say, on the local TV, but nationally. Are those things we should start being even more concerned about? Because, you know, the argument can be made, whether valid or not, that professional athletes chose this profession, they should just get thicker skin, whatnot. But when it comes down to high school athletes, kids who are still going through the hormonal changes and whatnot, do you concern yourself with that, this idea that more and more of the younger people are going to be exposed to this?
Yeah, that is concerning to me, particularly going even younger this summer. Well, every summer for the past several years, the Little League World Series has been on. This particular year, in the final game, the American team, I can't remember where they were from, but were running out of pitchers. The coach's son had to go in, and he was just struggling on national TV with millions of people watching. And his father had to come out and sort of counsel him as a coach, but also as a father. And some people thought his words were a little harsh. He said he was pitching scared. And I could see the boy about to cry. I know I wouldn't want to go through that when I was 12 or 13 years old. And it's just such a spotlight to be on a world stage like that, that I think it's very unreasonable to expect 13-year-olds to be prepared for that.
Derek Martin is a lecturer in the Sport and Society program at the U of A. We wanted to find out if schools have specific policies when it comes to preparing young athletes for the intensity of a game and the extra attention they could get from fans in the stands. Adam Rasmussen is the athletic director at Gilbert Christian School. Adam, how do you make sure, as much as possible, that your student athletes are not going to start a fight or cuss at a referee or even get overly excited when something good happens?
Any sport is going to bring out character issues. So when students are put into different environments, whether they are behind in score and they're really struggling to get caught up, or if there's a bad call, or maybe something great happened, like you mentioned, there's a celebration after a goal, students are going to have this time of seeing what's inside. That's going to come out during those moments. And, you know, it's a good thing that most of the time it's pretty great for most students. On the other hand, there are times when something not so good will come out. And there are always consequences. It may come from the ref themselves. It will certainly be visited by the coach, parents, the athletic director, if need be, in proper fashion. And so as that character comes out, that's part of education, is to develop both the mind and the character of a student. And there are certain things that just can't be taught in the classroom. They're taught better on the field or on the court. And so those character issues, as they come out, nobody's perfect. Everybody's growing. And today we're talking about just the pressures on athletes. And those pressures are real. And these students, they're young, they're minors, and they're going to make mistakes. So we have to have things in place to help them when they do.
If they run into something that is a less than ideal situation, what sort of teaching goes into before that happens on the field? Now listen, if that situation happens, here's how you need to react.
We do address it as a school, and so we have a code of conduct that we have every student read, understand. That student and their parents have to sign off on it, and we just start with some basics. The coaches teach from that code of conduct. We can always refer back to it. It's kind of built in to know that we're going to have some mistakes. In addition to the code of conduct, when there are infractions in any way, we have opportunity to teach. It might just be the coach pulling the student aside, and he or she already knows, oh, I blew it. And the coach can kind of debrief and encourage them. They can show them a better way, work with the students on those things. And then there are times when we actually do some training with the students on, here's how you are going to use social media yourself. And so sometimes the coaches will provide that in advance.
Now, we are overwhelmed by technology. Do you think this is a harder period to get student athletes to behave the way that, you know, we'd like them to behave?
No, I don't think it's any worse or any better. I think that I'm kind of a perennialist. People kind of stay the same. I think that we do have certain structures in our society that are bigger than social media. So some of the things that students could count on maybe in the 50s or earlier, they're not able to count on. But on the other hand, there would be other resources at their fingertips. And so I think it's a wonderful time of opportunity. It's a wonderful age of opportunity for parents and teachers and coaches to come together, for students that are wise to really take stock in their whole life, not just what's on the court, but who am I? You know, what am I trying to accomplish here? And one of the things that's tough about social media is it kind of speeds things up. If they make a mistake, they can get themselves in a hole pretty fast. And I think that's probably the one danger that's new.
Adam Rasmussen, athletic director at Gilbert Christian School.
It's post time again at one of the Valley's original sports venues. Turf Paradise opens the gates this weekend on its 60th anniversary season. And as KJZZ's Phil Latzman found out, horsemen and track operators feel the sport of kings still has a castle in Phoenix.
The facade of the track's grandstand still looks much like it did when Turf Paradise first opened back in 1956. But track general manager Vincent Francius says that's about the only thing that looks familiar.
There was Turf Paradise, and that was it. Everything around Turf Paradise was desert. What we now know is a very busy thoroughfare in Phoenix. Bell Road back then was a dirt road, and there wasn't anything on it.
Francia says even before the track opened six decades ago, the state has always had a special connection to the equine world.
What keeps the sport going and what keeps Turf Paradise healthy is this affinity between humans and horses. It's a connection that goes back in Arizona history to the time that it was a territory, and even before. The state was totally dependent on the horse for its development.
And that, he says, made Turf Paradise the logical spot to become Arizona's first professional sports franchise 59 years ago. In its heyday, the track hosted tens of thousands of patrons who came to watch live horse racing. Today, not so much. Scott Stevens is a longtime Turf Paradise jockey.
With the off-track betting, we don't get the crowds that we used to get, which, you know, for me as a jockey, you get with the crowd, it brings energy. So, you know, the more people come out, the better it is.
Bettors also have other options for their discretionary income, such as nearby casinos, which also siphon business away from the track.
They're one of the few tracks that are still going that don't have a casino to help them, back them up. And, you know, they struggle, but it's still a big tradition, and a lot of lives are back here. You know, they make their living back here.
Stephen's entire family makes a living off the horse racing business. His father was a well-known trainer, and his brother Gary is a Hall of Fame jockey. The back here he's referring to is the large area adjacent to the track, home to 1,900 horses and several thousand horsemen and women who habitate Turf Paradise's stables during the track's 7.5-month meet. Trainer Stacy Campo is among them.
I got horses over here, got my sand pit, got pretty much set up for, I think, 10 horses here right now. So all the horses you see here were all born in Arizona.
It's all in the family for Campo as well. The 44-year-old is an Arizona native and a second-generation trainer following in her father John's footsteps. She says it hasn't always been easy staking a claim in what's known as the sport of kings, especially nowadays.
Everybody was making so much money for so long, and people were really getting in the racing. When everything kind of went south, some of these tracks really got hurt. And if you don't have the money, it's hard to keep these horses going.
But trainers like Campo are hoping the attention surrounding American Pharoah, the sport's first Triple Crown winner in 37 years, has helped revive interest in horse racing, and by extension, at this historic track. American Pharoah was trained by fellow native Bob Baffert, a graduate of the University of Arizona's racetrack management program.
He's a great horseman. Being able to set up a program like we have here. I don't think there's only two places you can really learn much about racing. And since Arizona offers it, a lot of people come to Arizona to be able to try to become the next Baffert.
A crowd of 4,000 people came to cheer on American Pharoah remotely at Turf Paradise last June when the Thoroughbred completed his Triple Crown run at the Belmont Stakes in New York. Scott Stevens says it's just the kind of publicity the sport needs to stay viable with a new generation.
I think that brings interest back, you know. Everybody wants to see a winner. Things like that I think will bring the younger crowd. We have to get the younger people back out here.
Turf Paradise's 60th season kicks off on Saturday with first post time at 12:55 p.m. In North Phoenix, Phil Latzman, KJZZ News.
It's almost time for the next episode of The Quiz Show. That's when we bring back our resident quiz master and Jeopardy! Tournament of Champions winner, Leszek Pawlowicz. He'll face off against a KJZZ staff member in a game of trivia, but you can get in on the action too. Just solve this puzzle. What occurs once in a minute, twice in a moment, and never in 1,000 years? When you have the answer, email us at theshow@kjzz.org. We'll randomly draw two names from the correct answers, and either Leszek or one of our KJZZ newsroom staffers will play on your behalf. If your player wins, you'll win a special KJZZ item.
There are some songs that evoke such strong memories that when we hear them, we're immediately transported to a different place and time. It can be a pivotal moment in our lives, a memory of joy or heartache, or just a point in the continuum of life that may have defined us. So we're going to explore this phenomenon in a new recurring segment on the show. It's the Time Machine. Let's go. And let's take a ride with the guy sitting across from me. You may know him as Mark Brody.
It's my freshman year in college at Syracuse. And for me, my freshman year was very much about sort of learning new things. You meet a ton of new people. You're exposed to different kinds of foods, different kinds of ideas that you learn about in your classes, and all sorts of different kinds of music. And to me, this was just amazing. Like all these new groups that I'd never heard of that were just so great. And one of them was Big Head Todd and the Monsters. So my friend and I would listen to this album just constantly in the dorm. You spend a lot of time in the dorm in central New York in the fall because it's really cold and it's not that much fun to go out. I distinctly remember going to the student center to buy the album, Sister Sweetly. It was a cold, cloudless, windy November night, very brisk, one of those things you kind of hunch up in your jacket. You don't want too much of your face exposed because, your nose hairs will freeze, things like that. The smell of wood fires burning, not much sound. There weren't really any cars on the street. There weren't a ton of people on the sidewalks. Just very sort of still night, which I think maybe made it easier for me to have this song sort of in my head because there weren't a lot of external sounds sort of cluttering things up. So we listened to this CD a lot, my friends and I in the dorm, and it was also kind of the soundtrack to one of those moments that you kind of wish didn't happen, especially when you're sort of still in the new phase of making friends and meeting people. Midwinter, walking to class, there's probably 40, 50 feet of snow on the ground, no big deal for central New York. So we're walking down some steps. Next thing I know, I'm on my rear end, sliding like I was on a cafeteria tray, ended up at the bottom of the stairwell with my friends just looking at me, stopped in their tracks, busting out laughing like they couldn't get enough of this. It was one of those moments that I realized, well, these guys are either going to be my friends and we're going to laugh about this for a long time, or they're not going to be my friends and they're going to go tell all these new people and laugh about it without me. And fortunately, we stayed friends and we all laughed about it together. Over the years, you know, the chill that I get from hearing that song, it's still because of the weather, don't get me wrong. It's still really, really cold there, and I still viscerally remember that. But it's also somewhat of a chill because I think about sort of where I've come from the time I was 18 years old till now, and everything that's happened, some bitter, but most of it, the vast majority of it, very, very sweet. And I'm so grateful for that experience that I had at college, that, especially that freshman year where everything was so new and all the people that I was surrounded with, the people that I was friends with then, the people with whom I'm still friends with today. And that song and that album were such a big part of all of that.
You've heard our time traveling tales. Now we want to hear from you. Is there a song that takes you back? Send us your memories in a tweet with the hashtag KJZZTimeMachine, and we'll pick one listener to take over the controls for the next installment of The Time Machine.